I walked in thinking that to be an original person in the world, a nonconformist who drives creativity and change, that you had to be four things. I thought you had to be a risk taker, you had to be full of confidence, you had to have great ideas, and you had to be the first mover. And I discovered that all those things were wrong. Not only wrong, but backward. It turns out that most of the original people in the world, whether you're looking at Nobel Prize winning scientists, successful entrepreneurs, creative musicians and artists, have these opposite traits in common, where they're pretty risk averse, they're not daredevils, they're cautious. They feel the same doubt and fear that the rest of us do. They just harness it as motivation as opposed to being paralyzed by it. They have bad ideas. In fact, they have more bad ideas than the rest of us. And that's how they get to some true originality, is they generate enough volume to get variety and stumble on something new. And they're not first movers, they're procrastinators. They start things early, but they are deliberately slow to finish because they know that good ideas often take time to develop.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today, we kick off our Best of 2016 series, in which we take a look back at some of our most impactful guests on the show. And if you're looking for a potential stocking stuffer or gift for friends or family for this holiday season, check out our book, Unmistakable: Why Only is Better Than Best. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to get a creative project off the ground or ditch your current hosting provider for a more reliable one, HostGator can help. They provide 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages just for Unmistakable Creative listeners. And if you want to switch, they make it easy and seamless and free to switch from your current hosting provider. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Adam, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, it is really, really cool to have you here. You know, I have been a big fan of your work for quite some time. And, you know, I right after I read Give and Take, I started following your work really closely. And then when I saw that you had a new book called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World, I was like, you have to come and talk to our audience. They're the types of people who will eat this up. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your background, your journey, and how that has led you to everything that you're up to now and everything with this new book?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you, Srinivas. It's so great to be here. I've enjoyed listening to some of your other guests, and you keep inviting really great friends. So I've heard rave reviews consistently. Gosh, how does my life story all weave together? It probably doesn't, but I'm going to try to make it seem sort of coherent. How's that?
Yeah, that works.
All right, so the things that jump out at me, I was growing up, I remember a few things standing out. One was my mother telling me that no matter what grade I got in school, as long as I worked my hardest, she would be proud of me. And then she would always add, but if you didn't get an A, I'll know you didn't try your hardest. And so, you know, that was a blessing and a curse of sorts. But I was, you know, I was one of these kids who always followed the rules. And, you know, I wanted to like please my elders and respect authority figures. And I remember getting called to the principal's office once and finding out that I was not in trouble, but I still cried because I was so worried about doing something wrong. And, you know, I think that I guess the past decade or so has been a journey for me to become more comfortable, you know, sharing new ideas, even if other people might not agree with them, and, you know, becoming more of a nonconformist. And, you know, as a psychologist, it's hard not to occasionally end up doing a little bit of me search instead of research. And so, you know, it's one of the topics I've been really curious about. But, you know, I guess if I've always had sort of unconventional interests at various points, and I'm interested in how we can help more people embrace those.
Cool. Well, that raises numerous questions, as you might imagine. So, you know, one of the things you've probably heard me ask a ton of people is about their early childhood. And, you know, you mentioned your mother, but I'm curious what other things are when you look back at the earliest memories of your life. Are there particular moments, people, or experiences that you think shaped, you know, who you've ended up becoming today and the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, my dad would always teach me these things that I thought were just like ordinary phrases. And then later I found out that he and my mom were both psychology majors in college. No one ever told me. And it was only after I became an organizational psychologist that I discovered this. But, you know, like I grew up like learning all the time about self-fulfilling prophecies. And, you know, like I guess it was like a curiosity about human nature and everyday behavior was sort of in the water growing up. Uh-huh. The other thing that, you know, that I guess jumps out at me right away is my grandmother was just one of the most generous people you could ever meet. And she lived just a few miles away, and she was really worried, you know, when we were young that my mom wouldn't get any time for herself. And she once drove 2.5 hours in a snowstorm. It was supposed to be a 15-minute drive so that my mom could go exercise for an hour. It's like you sit there thinking, wow, that's just an amazing amount of love and dedication to other people, and I would really like to be more like that. So, you know, those are a few things that jump out at me. And then when I was in high school, I got into springboard diving because my mom had dragged me to a local pool, and she was worried that I was playing too many video games and I needed some sun and exercise. And I saw this lifeguard on break doing tricks, and it turned out he was like a state finalist diver, and I was just mesmerized. I wanted to learn how to do it. Never mind that I was afraid of heights. But I had an incredible coach, Eric Best, who saw way more potential in me than I saw in myself. And that, I think, was the first moment that I really thought about doing something that I was afraid of.
Those moments of being mesmerized, I mean, you, from the perspective of an educator, why do you think that so many people miss those moments in their lives? Like, why do we overlook moments like that? And do you recognize that that was a moment like that only now in retrospect, or did you know what you were getting at the time?
I don't know. I think, you know, at the time I was stunned that I showed up basically having spent a summer, you know, like taking a couple of diving classes and like trying to walk on to the team as a freshman in high school. And I saw what some of the other kids could do, and I knew I was not qualified. And Eric sat me down and said, you know, do you want the good news or the bad news? And I was like, start with the bad news for sure. And he said, well, you know, I diving requires explosive power and grace and flexibility, and my grandmother can jump higher than you, and you can't touch your toes, and you walk like Frankenstein. And, wait, there's good news? And he said, yeah, diving is a nerd sport. It attracts all the people who are too slow to run and too weak to play football and too short for basketball. And if you work really hard at this, you can become, by your senior year, one of the best in this state. And, you know, the first part was a joke. But I think that, you know, that's something that so many teachers and mentors miss, because it's so difficult to do what Michelangelo had a gift for. Right, which is to look at a block of stone and imagine seeing the David in it. And that's what we all have to do when we work with other people, but it requires quite a leap of imagination.
So that raises a couple of questions and a comment. It sounds almost identical to the story that I have with a 7th grade band director telling me I would be able to do the same of all things with a tuba, which I did.
It's a good thing I did not have that director, because it wouldn't have gone well and we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, it turns out
you had some musical talent, right?
I did, but it turns out that to get a job as a professional tuba player, you literally have to wait for somebody to die, because there's only one in an orchestra. So I can't help but wonder if people, you know, instead of looking at job boards every day, look at obituaries if they're professional tuba players.
Oh, jeez, that's so sad.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I'm curious about is the diving experience, how that influenced and shaped what you've done later in your life. Like, what lessons from that whole experience have you applied to the work that you do today? And you know, did you apply going forward in your life?
I think the biggest thing I took away from it was discipline. You know, I would go day in and day out to do things that terrified me and also caused a reasonable amount of physical pain. So, you know, like a typical day a couple years in, you know, as I started to get more competitive, was I'd have to get up on a 3-meter springboard, leap, you know, at least 10 feet in the air, ideally higher, otherwise it was guaranteed to be a disaster. do a few somersaults and a twist, and hit the water at 30 miles an hour where it feels a lot like concrete. And, you know, occasionally I would come out with such a deep bruises that it literally hurt to move for 6 weeks. And the pain was some of the worst pain I've ever felt. And, you know, I would have to do this and then go up and do it again. But worse than that was just the terror of getting lost, you know, the hurling yourself into the air and having no idea where you are and which direction you're facing and where you're spinning. I guess facing those fears and pushing myself through them. You know, I remember getting to college having done a lot of that and, you know, roommates complaining about, oh, this reading is really boring. I'm like, this hurts so much less than diving, which is supposed to be fun, and I do it as a sport. So, you know, I guess that was a useful skill. The other thing I took away from it was Eric would, you know, when I was scared to try a new dive, I would stand on the board for sometimes as long as 45 minutes, which is like, you know, a third of practice. And, you know, obviously no one was happy about that. And I eventually got to the point where he would just say, Adam, are you going to do this dive or not? And I would say yes, because I was committed to getting better. And I had, you know, I guess high standards and expectations for myself. And he would say, well, if you're going to do it anyway, why don't you just skip the 45 minutes and get it out of your system? And it was one of my earlier lessons in, you know, in the power of psychology, because he was able to take this thing that I had no desire to do and reframe it as something that I could not wait to do. And that, you know, that left me wondering what else we ought to learn about how we can motivate other people and how we can motivate ourselves.
Okay. So that raises a question of, two different things. You know, obviously, I read about your work habits in Cal Newport's book, Deep Work. And I'm really curious just about, you know, productivity systems that you put in place to motivate yourself and this ability to be this disciplined and produce at the level that you do at the, you know, with the level of output that you do. Is that something you think can be learned, or do you think that is something that is cultivated and developed through experience?
Can I pause for 1 second?
Yeah.
I think I'm about to lose my connection. Hold on 1 sec. Still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. We had a cable guy here, and I just got the signal that they might go down, but we are all good.
Okay, so, no worries.
Okay. You read about me in Cal Newport's book. I'm sorry that you had to suffer through that. The book was great. The part about me, I was a little mortified by.
Well, I think what it raises for me is a question around discipline and productivity systems. And do you think that the capacity for discipline that you have and the ability to produce at the level that you do with the amount of output that you do is something that can be learned and developed? And if so, how?
Yeah, of course. There's a great body of research on this that Robert Eisenberger spearheaded more than 2 decades ago on what's called learned industriousness, which is literally like the acquired capacity for self-discipline and willpower. We know now that, you know, a lot of discipline seems to be like a muscle where you work it initially and then it tears, but then it builds itself up. And, you know, I think a lot of learning discipline is starting by experiencing flow and getting so fascinated by something that you fall into this, you know, like I'm in the zone moment where you lose track of time, you don't notice your surroundings, and pretty soon hours have gone by. And for me, you know, I guess learning discipline was a lot of saying, I need to get good enough that I can get into flow in this task. And when something's hard, usually that disrupts flow if it's too hard. And so, you know, if I continue to persist at this task that's really frustrating, then, you know, I'll develop enough mastery that I can totally get engrossed in it. And that was always something to look forward to and work for. Mm-hmm. I also think that, I mean, we know so much now about, you know, building grit and developing growth mindsets. And, you know, something as simple as, you know, as saying to a child, you know, when they give up when math is hard, you know, that feeling of math being hard is your brain growing, right? That kind of reframing is enough to motivate persistence. And what is discipline other than, you know, a bunch of acts of persistence strung together that you feel like you're in charge of?
So from the perspective of an educator, what have you noticed as patterns in your own students when you see them hit moments of flow or moments when they have stumbled upon something that they are completely drawn towards and have the potential for mastery in?
I don't know. This is something I would like to know more about, right? Because I think it's one of the greatest moments that you have as a teacher. Uh-huh. Is when, you know, you open a student's eyes to something that, you know, that all of a sudden this reaction is like, wow, I never knew there was something this fascinating out there and I can't wait to know more about it. I don't know though. You spend a lot of time thinking about this. You have conversations with tons of interesting people. What's your take on it?
You know, I think that in a lot of ways, having been through our education system, I often joke that I'm a failed byproduct of the education system. And I went to a good school. I went to Berkeley. And yet I felt that I was in the wrong place. Like if I look back at it now, I'm like, it was a total mismatch of talent and environment. So I think it often depends on having the right people to bring it about, the right circumstances. I mean, so much of what I've done at this point, getting to write books and do all of this is entirely accidental because I couldn't find a job. So I kind of can't help but wonder if without the circumstances being what they were, I would have just settled for average. Like I would have been like, all right, cool. Like I can go through this easy sort of middle of the road life because the circumstances don't suck. I think often, you know, I talked to Salim Ismail from Singularity University, and what he had talked about is a forcing function, something that actually becomes the catalyst for the kinds of changes and the kinds of success that we're talking about.
Yeah, I can see that making a lot of sense. I also think, you know, Reid Hoffman said something really interesting a couple of weeks ago. He said that for him, you know, a lot of developing, you know, some degree of focus and discipline to continue at things that you're failing at or other people are rejecting was to have confidence in himself as a learner, mm-hmm. which I thought was such an interesting phrase because normally when we think about confidence, it's about knowing that you have a certain skill. And he's talking about confidence in a meta skill. Like I am confident that I can improve my other skills. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I would really love to know more about how to help kids and adults develop confidence in themselves as learners. That strikes me as something important to understand more.
Yeah. I mean, as you might imagine, I have tons of questions related to education for you, but one more before we go there. Dan Coyle told me I had to ask you about your time working as a magician, and I figured anybody who goes from magician to Wharton professor, there's got to be an interesting story there. So we have to talk about that. And also the other question that comes with is what did being a magician teach you about the work that you've ended up doing today?
Right. So the short version of the story is I babysat for some kids when I was 12 down the street who were pretty hyper. And one week they got into magic tricks and they actually sat still. So I went home and got a magic book and learned some tricks and found that I really enjoyed, you know, both learning the skills and actually delivering the trick and, you know, kind of bringing this element of surprise to the table. And I also discovered that as a pretty shy kid, it helped bring me out of my shell. The magic gave me, you know, something to talk to other people about and a way to connect with other people. And so I started doing more and more of it. By the time I got to college, it was helping me pay for school. And I did literally the nerdiest thing ever in college. I co-founded a magic club. Like, magic is nerdy. Magic club takes that to a whole different level, right? And my co-founder, David Kwong, actually went on to become a professional magician and is doing some pretty amazing things. And I'm very glad he quit his day job and I did not. But I, you know, what I learned from magic really was the importance of the element of surprise. Uh-huh. That, you know, I could do the same trick, and depending on how I set it up, the audience could be, you know, kind of amused or totally flabbergasted. So I spent, you know, I guess a lot of my time as, you know, as a professor and a writer trying to figure out how do I create that same element of surprise where we introduce a study or a story and it takes an unexpected twist, and you're all the more intrigued because of it.
Hmm. Well, so speaking of your work as a professor, I mean, that's obviously how I think most of us who are listening know about you. I'm really curious about one thing. You know, I think it's really interesting that you have a book called How Nonconformists Move the World, and yet you work in an educational institution. And I think that's, personally, I find that to be somewhat of an odd paradox, especially because you're sort of at the upper echelon of our education system. So I have some questions around, you know, what are your thoughts on education in its current form? You know, a lot of parents who are listening to this use content from our show to homeschool their kids. So I'm curious what you'd say to them. And then when you look at something like what Seth Godin is doing with Alt-MBA, especially given that you're at Wharton, what are your thoughts on that? So like four questions in one, I realize.
And where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with your views on this sort of nonconformist paradox of work being somebody who writes a book about nonconformity, who embraces nonconformity, but yet works in an educational system that for the most part is driven by conformity.
It's so interesting to me that you see a paradox there at all, because a part of the reason that I was drawn to university life was knowing that I would have the security and protection of tenure to be able to champion ideas that were nonconforming, that went against the grain, that many people might find hard to believe. And I think that that's our charge, right, as professors and as researchers, is to try to understand the counterintuitive, the unusual, the counternormative even. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, well, I guess what I would say is I think we do a better job accomplishing that in our research than we do teaching it in the classroom. As a former editor of a major management journal, one of literally the first thing that I look at when a paper is submitted is it interesting? And interesting is literally defined as, does this challenge conventional wisdom in some way? Mm-hmm. Does it either shift our consensus or create new consensus? And, there's a real premium placed on original thought and, people who don't conform to what existing evidence necessarily suggests or what prevailing theories, suppose. In the classroom, I think that, we've done a really poor job for the most part, that higher education and secondary education too, the primary goal is basically to teach students a body of codified knowledge that they can regurgitate. Mm-hmm. And we do a horrible job teaching kids to think for themselves. And then, I worry a lot about elite institutions attracting the most conforming high achievers who become these ambitious robots who, master everything that's already known and do absolutely nothing original. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is something that, I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And one of the great things about writing a book is that you have to confront your own hypocrisy. So I ended up redesigning a big part of my semester-long class while I was writing this book because I felt like I was failing so miserably on the originality dimension.
So you have students that really are resistant to the idea of nonconformity. I'm curious how you break them of that conditioning, at least from your perspective. Because I feel like that's half the work of an educator. And to me, I think I said in my own book that half the spiritual journey of adulthood is basically unraveling all the layers that we've acquired through adulthood and to get back to a place of what we were like in our childhood.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of unlearning there. I think I'll tell you where I started, which is I created a new assignment for my class, knowing that if there's anything a conformist high achiever loves, it's a chance to earn an A. And I thought, okay, I'm going to bake nonconformity into the evaluation process and see if, that because they're motivated to do well in class, if that's something they will get excited about. So I did it later in the semester because, look, I teach a class that's basically evidence-based management. And I do want students to know what the best data have to say about the problems they will face as leaders, managers, employees, and parents too. But I felt like once they had internalized some of the core, bodies of research in the class, it was time to let them challenge it a little bit. So in November, I gave them an assignment. It was a fall class. I said, what I want you to do is pair up with somebody. It's up to you whether you want, you get to pick your own partner or you want to be randomly assigned. And as a dyad, your job is to film a 5-minute TED talk about an idea around work or psychology or human behavior that you believe in, that you think is counterintuitive, and that ideally challenges something you've learned in this class. And then they had a couple of weeks to work on the project. They filmed their mini TED Talks, and I was blown away by the originality of the ideas that were expressed, but also the creative ways that they found to express them. Mm-hmm. And I realized that actually there was a ton of latent originality that I was just thwarting by not giving them the opportunity to express it. And I think that, giving them an assignment where they had to do something different and they had to use a medium that's not normally engaged in the classroom was enough that they were pretty comfortable going out on a limb.
Can you share a specific example of one of your students and what surprised you the most out of this experience?
Oh, yeah. One of the top talks this year was a talk on why women should be allowed to have babies with them in prison. Huh. So if a pregnant woman is incarcerated, they said, what we believe is that every state and every country should have a law that, you know, a woman should not be separated from her child. And obviously there's been some concern about the well-being of the baby, but we should also be concerned about taking babies away from their mothers. And they brought a bunch of research to bear on it. They looked at, some really cool experiments they found about how growing up without a parent and especially without a mother affects kids. And they made a really compelling case, and it was well-delivered and funny. There was one the previous year, the first year that I tried this experiment. It was a TED Talk about why we shouldn't give TED Talks. That was so clever. And of course, I disagreed with the fundamental premise because I love TED Talks, as we all do. But I thought, I respected the courage that it took to do it. Uh-huh. And, they actually came up with some interesting arguments about how if you're not careful, you could just end up conforming to what you're hearing in TED Talks, and you need to give your own, not just listen to other people's. And then they gave their own meta TED Talk. It was all quite delightful.
Well, I've always jokingly said that the ultimate paradox of nonconformity is the amount of people conforming to its ideals.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I actually think at this point, conformity is almost the new originality, right? Because of that. Like if I hear one more person tell me, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I have an app. Uh-huh. I'm like, I think we have a lot of apps already. Tell me what's new about yours.
Yeah. So this obviously raises more questions about the classroom. I'm curious why you think in our education system, the kind of thinking you're talking about is not more prevalent and more universal. And, when I asked Salim Ismail about this and the work that they're doing at Singularity, he was saying, it's kind of nuts because by the time most people finish a degree, the degree is outdated. And the challenge they're having at Singularity University, the reason they can't become accredited is because they update their curriculum so frequently, which that's ridiculous to me. So I'm curious, from where you're standing and your vantage point, what is the future of this going to look like? And why do you think we're so resistant to ideas like the ones you have? Like, why are they not more prevalent in our education system?
Wow. I mean, accreditation, I think, is a mess, right? At Penn, we had to extend the school year because we were in danger of having not enough days to qualify.
Wow.
as if students are going to learn more by tacking on a few extra days, right? I would say give them fewer days and challenge them to be creative in the extra time they have free. Why is this kind of thinking not more prevalent? I think that there are probably a couple of reasons. One is a system justification problem. So you're familiar with system justification theory. I think it's such a powerful theory that people want to live in a just world, and they have a hard time questioning whether the systems that they are part of are right because they've been served well by them in the past in this case. So if you have a bunch of people who have been standout students and who have been successful under that model, how could there be anything wrong with it? Mm-hmm. I think that's one factor at play. I think another thing is, anytime you embrace change, it becomes unpredictable. And, there are a lot of people who worry that we're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. If we're constantly updating the curriculum, then how are we going to know what we're actually teaching and how will students be prepared to learn? I guess where I stand on that is, yes, we should have a codified body of knowledge that students need to learn about a domain. But I'm pretty sure that that does not include, if you're learning math, like, do you have to learn the second derivative in calculus? I don't know. I would like to see, some smaller list of the basics and then allow accreditation to be determined by, the contributions of your students 5 years out as you begin to see what they add to the world, or, some consensus among, faculty at a few other schools who themselves are nonconformist that you are not doing a complete disservice to your students.
Hmm. What do you think the future of this is going to look like?
I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine that, a dramatic amount of change is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years because there are a lot of schools that, have very little to gain and a lot to lose by making major changes.
Right.
I will say I'm very excited to see what Rebecca Cantor ends up doing. She's an entrepreneur in residence at GLG right now, and she has some pretty bold ideas for reinventing education. Imagine, for example, if Peter Thiel and Harvard had a baby, what that institution would look like. I have a feeling that that's the kind of thing that she would want to create, and I imagine it's going to be pretty exciting. But I guess, you know, as you pointed out, it's really hard for a lot of institutions to gain legitimacy when they're doing things that are radically different. Well, here, let me give one practical prediction, which is we have this whole debate about, you know, instructor-driven versus, you know, sort of student-led learning, right? So should, like, I as a teacher be delivering information to my students, which is spoon-fed to them, or should they be doing more self-directed learning? And I think that's a wrong question. I think it's a false dichotomy. I think the most effective model is peer-to-peer learning, where students have to go and understand an area themselves, and then when they really master it is when they teach it to others. Mm-hmm. We have known for decades that the best way to learn about something is to teach it. And why we don't have more classrooms that are organized in part around peer-to-peer learning is completely beyond me.
So that, I think, makes a perfect setup to ask you one last question, and then we'll get into the book itself. I'm curious what you think about things like Seth Godin's Alt-MBA, which kind of embraces this whole idea of peer-to-peer learning. I'm guessing you're somewhat familiar with it.
Yeah, Seth is a friend, and you know, he's one of the great originalists of our time. So I'm a big fan of the four-week format. I think intensive learning is the way to go. I don't think it makes any sense to say, you know, we're going to lecture at you for 12 years and then assume you'll know something about this topic. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of doing it online is really compelling. I think there are some aspects of learning that are hard to substitute for, kind of the face-to-face experience. But I'm excited to see where it goes. And I think, you know, we at Wharton, we've done more and more sort of intensive module-based learning. In fact, the core leadership and teamwork class that I co-teach for our MBAs is literally a week long. And it's all the students are doing during that week. And I think we're going to see more institutions moving in that direction. So I think Seth is onto something pretty exciting.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So given that we're right around the corner from the end of the year, it's a perfect time to start that creative project you've been thinking about. Don't wait until the new year and give yourself a head start by building a website. As I've always said before, one of the easiest first steps to any creative project is to just build a website for it. Unfortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic to help you get started because they provide 24/7 live support via phone chat and email. They have a super easy to use website builder if you're not tech savvy. And if you want to switch providers from the current hosting provider that you have, they make it free and really easy. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you get 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's get right into the framework for the book, because I think, you know, part of what I appreciate about work that people like you and people like Brené Brown do is that it's all rooted in research as opposed to sort of opinion, which, you know, a lot of creativity, work tends to be a lot more opinion driven. And especially,
wait, hold on. You don't want me to just make stuff up? Come on. Well, so much fun.
Yeah. If there's anything I learned in the process of writing a book, it was how often I was asked to back up things with examples. Like every single thing I said, you need an example to, you know, make that legit.
And you're like, no, I need a statistic. Thank you very much.
Really what I'd like to do is dive into sort of the framework for this, because I love the fact that it's research based. And I think you also shed light on some things that people might have some misperceptions about. So is there a way we could sort of look at the framework at a higher level and then go into sort of the impact based actions to do something more concrete?
Absolutely. Where do you want to start?
Let's start at the very beginning. I think just the whole idea of creative destruction, I mean, just the entire framework from the book. Like if you could outline those six chapters in 5 minutes, if that's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Just jump in wherever you want. You want to interrupt, because I'm always wary, like podcast style, of being a talking head, right?
No, so feel free to talk for as long as you want.
The fun of this is like that we get to have back and forth.
Yeah.
And you will generate new content, right? So, but here is, you're editing all this, I assume. I guess where I would start is to say, look, I walked in thinking that to be an original person in the world, a nonconformist who drives creativity and change, that you had to be four things. I thought you had to be a risk taker, you had to be full of confidence, you had to have great ideas, and you had to be the first mover. And I discovered that all those things were wrong. Not only wrong, but backward. It turns out that most of the original people in the world, whether you're looking at Nobel Prize winning scientists, successful entrepreneurs, creative musicians and artists, have these opposite traits in common. where they're pretty risk averse. They're not daredevils. They're cautious. They feel the same doubt and fear that the rest of us do. They just harness it as motivation as opposed to being paralyzed by it. They have bad ideas. In fact, they have more bad ideas than the rest of us. And that's how they get to some true originality, is they generate enough volume to get variety and stumble on something new. And they're not first movers. They're procrastinators. They start things early, but they are deliberately slow to finish because they know that good ideas often take time to develop. And those discoveries really turned upside down my understanding of what it took to be original. And it made me realize that original people are not as different from the rest of us as I thought. And I was writing off a lot of people as not likely to be creative. And I was also writing myself off. And, you know, so the book is, in many ways, it's about the sequel to creativity. So, you know, lots of people have original ideas. And where the big gaps exist is they just don't generate enough variations on them to make them, you know, promising. They don't know how to judge whether an idea is any good. And then, you know, they need insight on how to speak up effectively and get heard and gain allies. And so, you know, I guess that's what the book is about. And then later I took the framework into, you know, some broader questions that you're already familiar with. But that would be my quick summary in a nutshell.
Okay, cool. Well, let's get into each one of them. You know, I underlined this line from the book, which said, you know, when we become curious about the dissatisfying defaults in our world, we begin to recognize most of them have social origins. Rules and systems were created by people, and that awareness gives us the courage to contemplate how we can change them. And, you know, it's interesting because you said that we have all these perceptions of people who are original, like risk takers, confidence, first movers. And this is a question I've asked people in some form or another. If you've ever seen an interview with Chris Sacca, he talks about this concept called the inevitability of success. And what he says about every person that he's invested in that has been a big success is that they believe that their success is inevitable. And I'm just really curious, you know, when you look at what you've said about, you know, harnessing the courage to speak up and to be original, do you think everybody has this inside of them?
I think everyone has inside of them the potential to do something original. I think, you know, often the hard part is, you know, developing the knowledge and skills and the, you know, the right kind of confidence to give it a shot. And, you know, I guess, you know, the data that I have don't track perfectly with Chris's experience, in the sense that I think that more often the people who go on to do original things in the world have come to convince themselves of the inevitability of effort. Mm-hmm. That they say, look, I don't know. I feel like, you know, I have the capability to do something important. I don't know whether I'm going to succeed or not, but I cannot live with myself as somebody who didn't try. Mm-hmm. And that's the way they overcome the paralyzing fear that freezes a lot of us, is they say, yeah, I'm afraid of failing, but I'm even more afraid of failing to try, of failing to matter. Right, I could fail by starting a business that goes bankrupt, but I could also fail by never starting a business at all. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to fail, I would rather be in the former camp than the latter. And, you know, I think that that leap is one that a lot of people have trouble making. And I think it's why so many of the, you know, the blue chip entrepreneurs that Chris has worked with have had that inevitability of success, is those are the people who, you know, who didn't hesitate. But, you know, I was struck. Elon Musk told me that he was convinced that Tesla was not going to succeed. Wow. And he was sure that the first few SpaceX launches would never get off the ground. And so I asked him, how did you find the motivation and the courage to do it anyway? And he said it was too important not to try. There was no inevitability of success there. In fact, in his mind, it was much more near inevitability of failure.
Wow.
But he just felt like the mission mattered so much. And, you know, he has this tremendous desire to, you know, create a sustainable future for humanity. And, you know, spaceflight is a big part of that. That he said, I can't live with myself if I don't give this a shot.
Wow. I think you have finally given me a satisfactory answer to that question. I have asked so many people that question, and I've never been able to get an answer that truly satisfied me. But that may be the most interesting perspective I've heard on it yet.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I credit it to Elon and to a lot of the other, you know, originals who I interviewed and who I read about. But mm-hmm. You know, I ran into Chris at TED, and we did not end up talking about this particular debate. But it makes me wonder how he would respond to it, because my instinct is he would say, Yeah, but you know, Elon Musk still believed that he was going to succeed. He just didn't know if he was going to succeed in this particular startup, right? Or if he was going to succeed in space. And you know, I guess the other thing, what I would say as we have this fake conversation back and forth, here's how I would attempt to win this debate.
Yeah.
I would just add that I think people have the relationship between confidence and success backward. They think you have to be one of these brash people full of conviction in order to achieve success. But confidence is actually won through success, right? So when you go and help to start PayPal and realize that a lot of the entrepreneurs who are doing crazy things in Silicon Valley are not different from you, they're not smarter than you, they just tried where you sat still, and then you do try and you succeed, you're like, hey, maybe I can do this after all. And your confidence grows in proportion to the things that you've accomplished. And I think too many people are waiting around for that magic moment when, you know, all of a sudden they feel like, I can do this. I have this amazing potential. And what they should do is charge forward anyway with plenty of doubt, and then know that if they achieve some success, that's where their confidence is going to build.
So We've talked extensively about the confidence piece. What are the misperceptions that we have about risk and success? And you know, what did your research reveal to that proved to be the opposite of what we think?
Well, my favorite study on this looked at entrepreneurs who have a choice. When they have an idea for a business, they can either quit their jobs, which is what the risk-seeking entrepreneurs do, or they can say, no, I'll play it safe, hang on to my day-to-day work and my salary, and start this business as a hobby on the side. That second group, it turns out, is 33% less likely to fail than the first group if you look at a nationally representative study of thousands of American entrepreneurs. And you know, I think what happens there is there are lots of entrepreneurs who are swashbuckling pirates, but those are the ones who screw up a lot. And the people who say, you know, I'm going to walk to the edge of the cliff and I'm going to triple check my parachute and then have a safety net at the bottom, those are the ones who make smarter choices. They also, instead of feeling rushed because they've made a full-time leap, you know, to get a product to market immediately and start bringing in some revenue, they feel like they bought themselves the time and the freedom to really do it right.
So I know that you opened the book with this chapter about blind-eyed inventors or blind investors and one-eyed investors, and I had to have you talk about the Warby Parker story because I felt like there was such an important lesson there in terms of recognizing creative ideas. And I'm just curious, you know, what are the lessons you took from that, and what are the lessons we can take from that whole story?
Well, I'm grateful to you for reminding me of one of my many failures. So Neil Blumenthal came to me when it was actually my first class at Wharton. And he said, you know, I'm thinking about starting this company to sell glasses online with three friends. And I just thought it was insane that who would ever buy glasses online? You know, you have to go into the store and try them on. Now, I was the wrong person to be evaluating that because I don't wear glasses. So I'm not exactly a credible candidate here. But one of the things that they did really cleverly was they said they changed their pitch over time. And they had so many people tell them, look, you know, if this was a good idea, someone would have already done it, that they had to show them how many domains, you know, were really slow for that to happen. So they went and said, we're going to do for glasses what Zappos did for shoes. And all of a sudden people are like, oh yeah, I didn't used to order shoes online, but now I do that. And I don't even think twice about it. Maybe the same thing could happen for glasses. And then GQ called them the Netflix for eyewear. And people are like, I used to go to Blockbuster and rent a movie, but I don't do that anymore. And you know, I really overlooked the power of taking an original idea that was unfamiliar and making it familiar by connecting it to a concept that people already understood. One of the big mistakes that I made was I thought it made them sound derivative. You know, like all these pitches that you hear today that are, well, I'm trying to do Uber for X. And I didn't realize that that was just a way of taking their original idea and, you know, making it something that other people could understand and wrap their minds about, around.
Where do human beings, like, you know, people listening to this, tend to go wrong in their own perceptions of things like this?
You know, I think a lot of people go wrong in that they think there are a couple of places people go wrong, actually. But the biggest one for me is that they compare existing ideas to prototypes of what would have been successful in the past. So you look at Warby Parker and you compare them to, you know, other people who are trying to sell stuff online, or you compare them to other eyewear companies. And those prototypes are not relevant because, one, they succeeded in a different market. And two, you're trying to disrupt the very model of what, you know, what allows this product to take off. And I think trying to use the past to analyze future success in a turbulent industry is just a generally bad idea. You should analyze the past to see what lessons you can learn from it, but don't assume they're immediately relevant to the environment you're in now.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the first mover advantage myth and, you know, dispel that one, because I think there's so much interesting research that you came up with on that as well. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll start looking at some of those actions for impact that you talk about at the end of the book.
Yeah, I mean, this was another Warby Parker thing, right? The day before the company launched, actually the night before the company launched, they still did not have a functioning website.
Wow.
It's like, you guys, you realize this whole business is just a website, right? That's literally all it is. And I thought they were toast because they had spent 6 months dragging their heels, just trying to name the company right and, you know, build the brand in a way that was creative. And meanwhile, you know, you have all these competitors, they missed their first mover advantage. They're screwed. And then you look at all the research and you see that most of the time, first movers have a disadvantage, not an advantage. And you can see this in almost every domain. If you look at 50 different product categories, over 500 companies, if you look at the automotive industry, the list goes on and on. And what's striking is that people think that to be original, you have to be first. You don't. You just have to be different and better. And it's much easier to improve on someone else's idea than it is to, you know, to create a market from scratch. So you're the first mover. You have to get people used to this whole idea of doing something completely new. And then, you know, somebody else can swoop in and say, hey, you just created a market for me. I can dramatically improve on your technology or make your product far more user-friendly. And, you know, I think it's one of the reasons that, you know, Facebook succeeded where Friendster and MySpace failed. It's one of the ways that, you know, Google was able to enter after, you know, Alta Vista and Ask Jeeves and Yahoo have gotten us used to searching. And that's, you know, I think if people realize, I'm not saying, you know, wait to be the last mover, that's not smart either, but don't rush to go first. That's not what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur, I guess would be the message.
Awesome. Well, let's do this. Let's look at the 15 actions for impact that you talk about at the end of the book so people can start thinking about how they might specifically apply this in their own work. And, you know, what I'd like to look at it is through two lenses, ideally. One, if you're not, you know, somebody who's an entrepreneur and just doing creative work, for example, if you're an artist, how this applies. And then, of course, you know, if you're working in an organization, how you can apply these concepts.
Yeah, I think the first and most important application here is, I think that when I work with entrepreneurs, leaders, students, they just do not have enough ideas. What I really want to see them do is triple their output. And they'll say, but like, I've run out of steam, or I already love my third idea. And I will come back and say, I have yet to meet an original person who only had three ideas. Right. And I think that, you know, a lot of people feel like, you know, after I've generated a few ideas, I've just run out of possibilities. And I would say that's the moment when you are ready to be original, because you've freed yourself of the most conventional ideas that came to mind first. So, you know, literally when you're trying to solve a problem or come up with a creative insight, whatever your normal target would be, I would say triple it and know that it's going to be harder. And you may have to procrastinate for a few days or at least a few hours and work on something that's a little bit mindless to let some unconscious processing happening, but that's where you will often improve your ability to do something truly new. Hmm. Where do you want to go next?
I know there were 15 of them in the book, like at the very back of it. So you tell me.
Yeah.
Anywhere you want to go. Well, the ideas one is interesting to me because, you know, I write 1,000 words every morning, and I was just thinking about 2013, which was the most prolific year I ever had. And I realized I attributed entirely to output, nothing else, not quality by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, 90% of what I write is unusable. But in that period, I self-published 2 books, produced a conference. We, you know, produced more than 100 episodes of a podcast. And that's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, you know, just as a quick riff on that, Kurt Vonnegut had this great distinction between bashers and swoopers. Mm-hmm. Bashers being the people who like write perfect sentences one at a time, and they don't move on until they've nailed each one. And swoopers, which it sounds like you're much more of, I am too. They just churn out a bunch of thoughts, and then they go back and they treat editing and revising as a separate process from generating.
Yeah, I would absolutely say that's exactly how my process works.
I love it. So I mean, I don't know. I don't think anyone should ever be a basher, uh-huh. And that's a strong statement. But if you look at all the evidence that's come out in the past few decades on what it takes to be original, it consistently says that quantity is the best path to quality. And as a basher, yes, you will churn out maybe a few things that are perfectly done, but I think their odds of being novel are lower, and you just generate a lot less output. As a swooper, you can get a lot more done and be every bit as original. So why not go that route? Other stuff. So, you know, another thing that I think is important from a practical perspective is I work with so many entrepreneurs and creative people who only talk about the positives of their ideas. And I loved this example of Rufus Griscom, who pitched his startup by telling investors, here are the three reasons you should not back my company. And ended up being wildly successful with that approach. I think that we were trained to do this in debate class, right? Address counter arguments. But we forget to do it when it comes to pitching new ideas because we just get so excited about them, or we're worried that other people are going to see the holes and we don't want to make that any easier. But if you're pitching it to anyone who, you know, is interested and knowledgeable, they're going to see all the flaws that you do. And you can show that you're balanced and honest and self-critical by saying, look, I have this idea. Here's why I think it's promising. I do have, you know, two or three big concerns about it, and I would love to chat about how you would go about addressing them. And then if you ask for the advice of your audience, you can actually engage them in a joint problem-solving dialogue, which is a much better way to present your ideas than this adversarial, no, all of your objections are wrong approach that a lot of entrepreneurs and creators get stuck in.
You know, it's interesting. I'm just finished reading Chris Hadfield's book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And it reminds me of that, because in their case, the consequences of, you know, this adversarial approach are literally death and billions of dollars. So they have to look at every potential worst case scenario. And I realized it was so weird. It was almost like 15 years later, my game theory class from college suddenly came full circle. I was like, oh my God, that's what we do every time we try a creative project. We're like, okay, what could go wrong here? And that's an important question to ask.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, we've learned so much from high reliability organizations on this. You know, if you look at spaceflight organizations, if you look at nuclear power plants, hospitals, airlines, anybody who has to maintain consistent performance where the costs of errors are devastating, what you see is there's a tremendous preoccupation with failure, and you want an environment where it's unsafe not to speak up. Mm-hmm. About problems and issues and flaws that you see. And I think that it would be really great if more organizations worked that way.
Mm. So one other question I have around this is in terms of communicating your ideas, when they're original and nonconformist ideas, to another group of people, like how do you enroll people in what you believe?
So I think one of the things that you do is you try to get more exposure to your idea. Most of the time, the evidence suggests that it takes 10 to 20 exposures to an idea before people are really comfortable with it. And the more original it is, you know, the more they need to sort of get their minds around it. So the advice is, when your boss goes and, you know, and shoots down your idea, you should just come back 6 minutes later and be like, here it is again. No, of course not. What you do is you say, you know that idea that you shot down on Tuesday? I've been thinking a lot about your feedback. You gave me some great advice. Today is, you know, is Friday. Here's a different way of thinking about it. What's your take on this? I think, you know, another thing that you do though is sometimes you have to hide what you're really after. This is another Elon Musk example, but he's been thinking about Mars for a while. But when he recruited engineers to join him at SpaceX, he didn't mention Mars because people thought it was crazy. What's this guy from payments going to be able to do to get us into space, let alone, you know, colonize another planet, right? So he became what researchers call a tempered radical, which is somebody who has an extreme idea, but, you know, sort of couches it in more moderate language. And he says, look, what I want to do is, you know, get a private commercial vehicle into space, into orbit, and then, you know, eventually let's get it back. And once they prove they can do that, now Mars does not sound so far-fetched. And I think that kind of tempered radicalism is what a lot of originalists have to master, because if you have a wildly creative idea, you know, the more transparent you are about what your mission and your ultimate vision is, the more people are just going to think that you're ridiculous. And, you know, if you can have some more moderate milestones along the way and start by explaining those, then as you build up some progress, you can start to unveil what's really in the Trojan horse.
So I've a couple of final questions for you. Knowing what we do about all of this, and especially given the perspective that you have on you know, being a psychologist and research and understanding human motivation, why do you think that if we have the capacity inside all of us to do original work and to do these kinds of things, we see such a wide spectrum of achievement when it comes to human performance? Which I realize we could probably do an entire book just on that.
There is a book waiting to be written on that. I know you have nothing better to do, Srinivas. You should go do it.
This has actually been the question, I think, that has been driving a significant amount of my work for the last 6 years.
And I mean, this is so cool. What's so cool about the podcast, right, is you bring in all these people who, you know, are not, there's not a gap between their potential and what they've achieved.
Exactly.
And some of them even believe that they've overachieved relative to their potential. I think a lot of it comes down to a combination of fear and futility. You know, the fear part we talked about, right? Being worried that you're going to look stupid or foolish or embarrass yourself in some way, and not realizing that in the long run, the regrets you have are the chances not taken, that those are the things you wish you could do over the most. And then futility being, you know, I don't believe that anybody's really going to take this seriously or hear me. Elizabeth Gilbert had a great observation about this. She said, all these people are going around and saying, I'm not creative. She said it's a bad sentence, and it's an irrational thought, because every person is unique in one way or another. And imagine just substituting I'm not creative with I'm not curious. You would laugh at that statement, she said, you know, and I think that's so powerful to say, look, if you realize that we're all curious, and even if you feel like you're not curious, you could wake up tomorrow morning and ask some questions that you've never asked before, or wonder about something that's always intrigued you but you've never pursued. And once you realize that curiosity is the starting point to being creative and doing something original, then you realize that we could all do a little bit more of that.
Well, this has been awesome, as I expected it would be. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable is such a hard thing to define. The irony is, like, when you talk about being unmistakably creative, when we define creativity, we talk about it, you know, as being novel and appropriate if it's art, or novel and useful if it's, you know, something in the world of business or technology. And how do you know whether something is novel or useful? The world's leading expert on this topic, Teresa Mavale, says you ask a bunch of people in that domain, and then if there's consensus among them that it's novel and useful, then, you know, if it's deemed creative, it is creative. And the more people deem it creative and the more confident they are that it's creative, the more unmistakably creative it is. And the irony of that is the more original you are, the harder it is for experts to agree, right, and achieve that consensus. So I think there's a paradox. I think that, you know, unmistakable on its face is consensus. But the more radically original something is, usually the slower, you know, we are to get to consensus. So I have no idea how to define it. And I think that's part of the beauty of your podcast is, you know, we all have our own ideas about what makes something unmistakable and unmistakably creative. And the less they overlap with other people's, maybe the better.
Wow. Well, this has been phenomenal, as I expected it would be. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights and your story, especially as somebody who's been a big fan of your work and all of your books. This has just been phenomenal.
I'm honored that it struck a chord. I'm a big fan of the podcast and your writing as well. And it's really cool to see a whole community of people come around or come together around this topic that I think is so important and probably not discussed or analyzed enough.
Well, I think that makes a beautiful way to wrap up our conversation. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next week on The Unmistakable Creative.
we overestimate how good we are at many things, but we underestimate how good we are at our ability to communicate in a way that's heard and remembered. And I was confused by that finding at first until we looked more deeply into the numbers and we saw that people feel like they don't matter enough to be fascinating. They're afraid to be fascinating. And this brings me to the second part of your question, which was, why do we become boring over time? And the answer is because as we grow up and we have situations in which we don't make the team, we get fired from a job, we're scorned by somebody that we love, we're rejected, we fail, we start to acquire these layers of boring, protecting us like a shield around us. But the problem is, our most extraordinary traits are not the ones that are the easiest to use. Oftentimes, what makes us fascinating, what makes us compelling, what makes people fall in love with us, whether we're creating content or we're going out on a first date, is what makes us different.
We revisit our conversation with author Sally Hogshead.